Hi there, podcast listeners. It's Doug Fabrizio here. The Radio West Book Club kicked off the new year by reading Aldous Huxley's classic sci-fi dystopia, Brave New World. When it was first published, this was in 1932, the book was reviled by critics for its anti-religion, its anti-marriage sentiments, but it didn't take long for people to realize that Huxley's society, this brave new world, free of aging and the usual pains of life, wasn't all it seemed. Radio West executive producer Christy Miners led the conversation with David Dunaway. He's a professor emeritus of creative writing at the University of New Mexico and author of the books Huxley in Hollywood and Aldous Huxley Recollected.
Aldous Huxley was born in 1894 to a family that is hard to think of any other way than the intellectual elite of Britain. His grandfather was T.H. Huxley. They called him Darwin's Bulldog, because as a biologist, he developed the research behind Darwin's work. He was the youngest ever member of the Royal Academy of Science. So when you come from a family like that, there are certain expectations. Everybody'd gone to Oxford for, three generations. He was a very tall, bright, gangly teenager. Eventually reaching just over 6'4", rather thin. He just seemed to flow as he sat down in a couch. He seemed to flow out over into the rug. From that family, there were some serious expectations. When he was a teenager, he went through three separate tragedies all at once, which changed his life forever. The first of these is that when he was about 16, his mother died fairly suddenly over the course of a summer. And to make matters worse, the expectations for how you perform in this family ended up killing his older brother, Trev, who hanged himself in the woods. And then if that wasn't bad enough, within the year, he fell blind when he was a student at Eton. Everybody else went home on spring break, and Huxley found himself pretty much alone. And he noticed his eyes were pinking up, and he went to the school nurse, said, "It's conjunctivitis, don't worry about it." But in fact, it was a strep infection in his eyes. And those progressed quickly, and within a few weeks, he was blind. Then the rest of his life was an effort to find some way to see beyond the physical obstacles that he confronted, because his corneas were left completely covered in one eye and allowed just a tiny bit of light in on his other eye. And it's to his credit and gives you some idea of the accomplishment of this man that he wrote 60 books with one quarter of one eye.
Seems like he really did push past that. I mean, it's incredible when you think about
what he accomplished. He starts out, he finishes Eton, he publishes two volumes of poetry. He becomes a literary journalist back in the days when literature was part of journalism. And he writes these great early novels, Chrome Yellow, Antique Hay, Those Barren Leaves, and in the process makes himself one of the most famous writers, even compared to contemporaries like Virginia Woolf, of British literature between World War I and World War II. World War I left a whole cultural group stung and wounded and bitter and cynical. And he tapped into that by making fun of the upper classes that he was allowed entry into by virtue of his name, though not his economic position. So these novels made him the most famous cynical writer, arguably, in the world. By the time he was 30, he had set out on a world tour. He had published four bestsellers. He literally traveled all around the globe, ending up meeting Chaplin in Hollywood, and that's another part of the story that we'll get to later. But Brave New World began in 1930, 1931, and it was published in 1932, and it was the source of fantastic scandal. One of Huxley's closest friends was D.H. Lawrence, who wrote books that were widely banned even before Lady Chatterley's Lover, in case some of you are familiar with that one. That's one that they may look funny at you if you check it out from your public library. And it was indeed banned widely. Anyway, A Brave New World, as you all know, is the story of a dystopia, the opposite of a utopia. It's set far into the future when, as you also know, the notion of family is very different. All the world's children are born in hatcheries and socially conditioned and left to their own devices according to their classes. And I think Huxley, you know, made a lot of English society is much more class structured than American society and has been from the days of medieval times on. And he made fun of that structure. And he also believed fundamentally that, as Neil Postman once put it, we don't have to worry about a nuclear winter when we're probably going to kill ourselves by amusing ourselves to death. And it's that cultural perspective that he brings. So I have this commentary from an interview, this book called Aldous Huxley, who says, Huxley was denouncing the dangers of society dominated entirely by reason and science. That he was saying that man could attain the kind of happiness in Brave New World only by ceasing to be human. Because you give up loving, you give up art, you give up philosophy, you give up science and anything but applied science, and then finally you're happy. You start being happy by stopping being human, a straightforward ethical and philosophical dilemma. A few years ago, working with California Public Radio, because I'm a radio producer as well as an author, I did a pair of pieces about Aldous Huxley in his California years, the ones covered by Huxley in Hollywood. And now, if you don't mind, I'd like to play you a little bit about Brave New World on the radio. So this is going to be different from some of your other experiences. And, you know, raise your hand if for some reason you can't hear it clearly enough. But here we go. This is Brave New World as the first novel about human cloning.
It has been over a year since scientists in Scotland cloned a lamb named Dolly. Other clones followed, chimpanzees, mice, pigs. A whole artificial barnyard. Today, we seem to be on the evolutionary fast track to the cloning of human beings. All of this was foreseen in Aldous Huxley's book, Brave New World, here dramatized in a 1956 CBS radio production.
Where in olden times, one egg made one embryo, which made one baby. Today, we've improved on all that. Now the egg will bud, will divide from 8 to 96 buds. And every bud will grow into a perfectly formed embryo, and every embryo into a mature baby, making 96 human beings grow where only one grew before. Progress.
In 1931, English author Aldous Huxley imagined human cloning on a mass scale. Embryos are cloned in test tubes and grown in a solution to make alphas, managers and technicians, or deltas and epsilons, destined to sweep and to dig. Brave New World is a negative utopia set in the 25th century when all of the Earth's children are born in hatcheries and the word mother has become an obscenity.
And here we have the bottling room. Little embryos carefully bottled being rocked gently to and fro as they did in olden days when carried by their mothers. Now, boys, you must learn to distinguish between smut and science.
Last month, a Chicago physicist volunteered to clone himself. His wife agreed to carry the embryo, which would be simultaneously the man's son and his own brother. Is cloning still science fiction? Arthur Kaplan is a philosopher at the University of Pennsylvania, specializing in medical ethics.
I first encountered Brave New World in high school, and I have to say, it has stuck with me as a book. We have three technologies that are out there that are going to intersect at some point, and we've got our foot on the path with each one. Those three technologies: genetic understanding, artificial creation of life through reproductive technologies, and neonatology will intersect to make it possible sometime in the next 20 or 30 years for us to have extracorporeal, outside the body, human reproduction. That is, started outside the body, maintained outside the body in an artificial environment like a neonatal unit or artificial womb, and then genetic testing brought to bear to sort of sort out, well, what kind of children do we want to grow?
The greatest fear expressed in Brave New World is that technology will someday overcome us, and that using it for human breeding could prove fatal for the human race. But Arthur Kaplan does not believe Huxley was anti-technology.
One of the deeper themes of Huxley is that he believed it might be possible to control and shape these technologies. He was trying to warn us about things to watch out for.
Kirpal Singh of the Singapore Technical University.
I think the warning is that if we are not careful, it is not brute, savage power that is going to be our next oppressor, but it is going to be the world of quick consumerism, quick chemical sensationalism, and quick jingoism.
In 1932, Aldous Huxley was starkly negative about how well humanity could be trusted with its own future. But 15 years later, after he'd left England for Southern California, he had second thoughts about his novel. The actor Burgess Meredith.
We were talking about how an up-to-date Brave New World might work. I remember that I brought up questions of, would you really write it this way today? And would it not be a different situation?
If I were now to rewrite the book, I would offer the savage a third alternative.
Aldous Huxley, reading the preface to the 1947 edition of Brave New World.
Between the utopian and the primitive horns of his dilemma would lie the possibility of sanity. Science and technology would be used as though, like the Sabbath, they had been made for man, not as at present, and still more so in the Brave New World, as though man were to be adapted and enslaved to them.
In the beginning, there was resistance to human cloning, Brave New World tells us. But through social conditioning and computerized genetic selection, it was soon possible to create a population happy with its lot. Malcontents were given an extra ration of soma, a euphoric drug Huxley invented to warn us of the dangers of a pill-popping society.
This is Aldous Huxley. And these are the sounds of the Brave New World, of test tube and decanter, of hissing injectors and gurgling blood substitute.
The title of Brave New World comes from the last act of Shakespeare's Tempest. Oh, Brave New World, it has such people in it.
People are concerned that this kind of breeding of people takes away from the sense of specialness and dignity that they want to associate with human life. And I think in the end, too, people have a notion that this is dabbling in things that are places where people ought not be. Today, I'm not sure we're so comfortable with the idea that we are the inventors of these technologies, and that theme is there, too. Should we play God?
Where in olden times nature allowed us only to have twins or perhaps triplets or so, today we can create scores, yes, scores of identical individuals. We can manufacture men and women in uniform batches. Think of it. An entire factory staffed with the product of one single egg. 96 identical individuals working 96 identical machines. At last, society really knows where it stands.
Thank you for sharing that. That's great. Jenny, in our chat, had a question that came up in your piece. She said the consumerism is one of the most interesting parts of the story, which you touch on in that. And she's wondering, do you think that Huxley would feel uncomfortable at all with how popular mainstream his novel has become?
Well, like the writing on the wall at Nebuchadnezzar's place, books arrive, find their time, and disappear. And I'm afraid that, say, George Orwell, Huxley's student at Eton, of all things, that place where he was blinded, has much more reputation today for Animal Farm and 1984 than Huxley himself. I think Huxley, like most of us, was a deeply complicated and conflicted individual. He really liked fast cars. His wife drove a Bugatti for Bugatti. He liked nice suits. But on the other hand, he understood that all of this is transitory, that joys and egos and greed and accomplishment is all something which passes. As a good Hindu, which he was, and a bit of a Buddhist, he believed that, you know, it wasn't who you, what you owned or what you looked like or what you did that mattered. What mattered was your ability to understand the linkages, the connectedness between human beings.
Do you have any sense what, you know, you touched upon these books that made him extremely popular as a writer, best-selling novelist, these satirical kind of house novels about the upper classes. Brave New World is very different, you know, it's often called a dystopian science fiction piece. Do you have any idea what was going on with him that made him take this turn into science fiction?
It is a cynical novel, the same way the cynical novels of the 20s brought him all this attention. You know, the working class and intelligentsia both love to read novels making fun of rich people. This is a deeply cynical book too. Mustafa Mon, the world controller, believes in banning all books, except he keeps a little stash for himself. Let me read you a comment that another person made to me about this book. Most of the students to whom I've talked about Brave New World have confessed to me that they first of all read it because it depicted what you might call an adolescence utopia, that everybody could have anybody else without any fear of consequences, because contraception was highly effective, venereal disease abolished, and much of the appeal of the early Huxley lay to the highly sexed but irreverent adolescent who was tired of the sexual repression inculcated by his schoolmasters and his parents, terrified of having sex with members of the opposite sex because of babies, and thought that in fact Huxley's dystopia was in fact something of a utopia.
Well, that makes me
think. Later on, as I say, he regretted this, and he, as you just heard, he wanted to push us towards a deeper understanding. It's his California period, a deeper understanding of human potentiality.
That reminds me of a quote I read from Bertrand Russell, who said that Huxley with Brave New World has undertaken to make us sad by the contemplation of a world without sadness. And that juxtaposition is very evident. You know, this is not, like you say, this is a deeply cynical book. And yet it is in this so-called utopia, which is actually, as you say, a dystopia, that he creates this. Some of these lines, we talked about this as a group. I think it was Jennifer, you made a list of some of your favorites as we were reading. And there's some incredibly pithy lines in this. It makes me wonder if this is the novels that he was writing and became famous for. This is echoes of some of those lines. But, you know, lines like, you and I were talking about this, David, ending is better than mending. Those who feel themselves despised do well to look despising. I mean, he has this incredible gift for these very clever, kind of one-off, pithy lines. Is that typical of his work, that you find that in his other books?
He is a stylist. And as a matter of fact, that's the great cue for me to read a few of his quotes that are from the back of Huxley in Hollywood, my half biography. Some serious and some funny ones. California and the West, including Utah and New Mexico, take seriously environmental issues. So here goes. Forgive them, for they know not what they do. But will there be forgiveness for those who know quite well what they're doing and how bad it is, but refuse nonetheless to stop? Everybody knows there's no question in this case of extenuating ignorance, that is sheer folly to cut down forests without replanting. But more money can be made that way more quickly. Over vast areas of the earth, the lumber industry is indulging in this kind of insane delinquency. 1962. Another one that speaks to, I'm fond of because it takes place in New Mexico. D.H. Lawrence lived up here near Taos. And the first place Aldous went to when he came to the United States in 1937 in an effort to slow the speed of war as a pacifist lecturer, he moved to the Lawrence Ranch, which is still there and still open to the public. He wrote a book called Ends and Means. We have thought of ourselves as members of supremely meaningful and valuable communities, deified nations, divine classes and whatnot, existing within a meaningless universe. And because we've thought like this, rearmament is in full swing, economic nationalism becomes ever more fierce, trade wars, and general war becomes increasingly more probable, 1937.
I think that's one of the things that struck all of us with this book was just how contemporary it felt. I mean, even in the technology, you know, I mean, we were all stunned by the fact that he's talking about television, you know, which seemed to us like something that should have come much, much later. Jennifer was wondering, you know, before we move on from his earlier work, is there a book or a couple of books in those earlier works that you would recommend?
Well, you know, this is knife sharp cynicism. And he had later on to regret this because he came to be a decidedly cynical individual. I guess I would try Chrome Yellow. But this is the problem, too, of reading 19th century fiction. This is, you know, 1925, roughly, 2022, I think. It reads at a different pace than today's romance and fast-moving thriller science fiction. It's a bit more studied. Jacques Bersonne, a critic and a composer, once said that Huxley is a very good novelist, but a great essayist. And so if you read some of the early short stories, there's a couple of collections of Huxley's works, they give you a broad overview of the kind of person he was. And of course, later on, there's the two short books that he wrote, the very controversial Doors of Perception and the paired nonfiction book, Heaven and Hell, which is all about how humanity across time has looked to paintings, to jewels, to bright clothing, eventually to psychedelics, to stimulate. He talks about Gregorian chants. There are 50 ways in that little book described of how people reach a condition of transcendence without drugs. He was trying to make the point that this is something that humans have always sought, whether it's in the form of a chemical vacation or devout prayer.
Got a couple of questions. And Thea asks, is Huxley predicting or condemning the
politicization?
Thank you very much. I knew I couldn't get it. Of science when Mond recommends not publishing a scientifically sound manuscript?
Well, I think in our own time, we have seen many examples of disregarding scientific knowledge under the most critical and extreme circumstances. This is, you might say, nothing new. People have always shot the piano player when they didn't like the tune. And this really isn't anything that different. When he came to America, and this is what inspired me, he tried to think of a new way of thinking, a way where people could have better health, they could have a better understanding of themselves, and could do the opposite from what Brave New World was talking about, which is fundamentally the control, to come back to your question, the control from outside of humanity's consciousness. It's also a kind of way of looking away from a rather embarrassing part of Huxley's ideas in the previous decade to Brave New World, when he and H.L. Mencken, the great essayist and popular journalist in the United States, were talking about the eugenics movement. Eugenics is all, this is a reaction to some extent, or a way of showing people that eugenics is kind of a bad idea. You shouldn't be planning your population and grading them and making some people sweep the streets from birth and others have a princely existence. We have that drastic and growing divide between the haves and the have-nots in our country. There's no question about it. You just look at what happened during the COVID and you see that separation. So whether or not science is paid attention to is an issue for our own time, isn't it?
Yeah, and Peggy also, she says the book seemed to slam capitalism. To quote from the book, self-denial doesn't feed industry. It's interesting, you know, this book is written in the 30s. This is a time when, you know, we're seeing a lot of different political movements come about. Marxism, socialism, you know, all of these ideas are coming out. I have to think that these were all feeding into his work at this time.
Look, in 1931, one out of five men, because men were the dominant force in the workplace other than family businesses, had no job and not any prospect. One out of five. Think about your own circle. Imagine one out of five of them unemployed. And at that point, you can truly understand a rejection of a capitalist system that obviously was not working. Huxley was unsympathetic to communism as practiced in the Soviet Union, got himself in some trouble with some of his artsy intellectual friends for just this reason. But he was a pacifist. He got rid of his cynicism or overcame it as the cynicism represented in Brave New World as he began to find a new way of thinking about himself. A really positive way of redefining how we move, how we think about the world. He found a conversion in the mid-1930s, right after Brave New World, to pacifism and eventually to mysticism connected with his visual quest.
Well, before we get into that, these later years, I think Checkers brings up a good point. David, we had talked about this, you and I had talked about this section, that it's a very pinnacle moment in the novel where John Savage is talking to Mustafa Mond. This is after Barnard and Helmholtz get banished to the island, if you remember this, and they have this long exchange. And John tells Mustafa that he likes the inconveniences of feelings. Remember this section? David, you have
it right here in front of me.
You want to read it?
You're claiming, says Mustafa, the controller of the world, you're claiming the right to be unhappy. Okay, says the savage, defiantly, I'm claiming the right to be unhappy. Not to mention the right to grow old and ugly and impotent, the right to have syphilis and cancer, the right to have too little to eat, the right to be lousy, the right to live in constant apprehension, the right to catch typhoid, the right to be tortured by unspeakable pains of every kind. There was a long silence. I claim them all, said the savage at last.
Mustafa Mond's response is also quite good. It's talking about cynical, the way he shrugs his shoulders and he says, you're welcome.
You're welcome.
You are welcome to all of them.
Once upon a time, there was an Eden and it gave you everything you wanted, except danger, except a sense of transgression, which somehow humanity needs, a sense of being a little naughty, eh? A little naughty. And that led to the apple, and we know what happened after that. Murder, as a matter of fact. So what I get from this is simply the recognition that even with all its faults, life is worth living. That even with the sickness, even with the sad, destructive side of humanity, the torturing, the defective bodies that we carry around, even with all of that, there is something more. And that's what the savage is asking for. I hope we don't have to all go out like him, though.
Okay. I do think John's ending is particularly interesting in this book, because it, and I really thought about this after I finished it, and I'd be curious if anybody has any insights, and David, yours especially, is, does he offer a compelling alternative to Mustafa Mann's Brave New World? You know, we even talked about if that's a...
But that's just what we heard. We heard Aldous himself saying that if he were to write the book again, he was dear friends with Burgess Meredith, who some people know as the Penguin in the Batman movies, but has quite a long career, and Paulette Goddard, who was a very popular woman who went on to marry Charlie Chaplin. But in these days, Paulette and Burgess were together, and they decided they would make a film, A Brave New World. And Aldous said, yes, but you know, then we'll reissue the book. But I need to say that now I would give the savage a third alternative. He would have the possibility of redeeming himself, of not just reacting in horror to situation that he found himself in, the crowd pleasing, the orgies, all of that. He would have a spiritual possibility. That's what I think Aldous was just saying and deeply believed.
Paula says, I found myself wondering about life on the islands as yet another alternative. I love that they saw it as an opportunity. It took Barnett a minute, but they did see going to the islands as a better way for them. And Mustafa even says as much, I would like to be there. That's a good place to be. So I think, Paula, you're onto something there.
Don't forget that Huxley's last novel was called The Island.
The Island, yeah.
Island, I think they finally dropped the prefix. Island was exactly the opposite, and he had a terrible time trying to write a utopia instead of a dystopia, a place where things work together. And all of his California concerns later on, the alternative health, alternative religions to Christianity, they all come together in that book. So if I were to give a further reading in our little session here, I would say, if you like the cynic that's represented in Brave New World, the wickedly funny individual, you would read Ape in Essence, which is a very short novel that he wrote after about also set in the future, but this time Los Angeles is entirely depopulated and only a group of savages live there, making fire from the books of the Los Angeles Public Library. If you like the positive utopian Huxley, then you would turn to Island, and you would try and see how a very cynical man becomes turned around by not necessarily love, but by group community and an inspiration in that direction.
Well, I want us to get to, since most of us don't know what happened to Huxley, after he wrote Brave New World, he moved to America and got involved, as you've mentioned, in Hollywood, writing films. Would we know some of the films that he has written?
You sure would. My favorite is Jane Eyre with Orson Welles. And if you know Orson Welles, well, I need say no more. But Huxley actually got deeply involved in writing that one. Then there's another one called Pride and Prejudice. Now, we Austin has had many a revival. I think now there's zombies in Pride and Prejudice, but this is no, there are no zombies in the original Hollywood send up of Pride and Prejudice that he wrote. And then there's a film that should be very contemporary now because it's the story of Madame Curie, 1937. It's one of these great Hollywood stories because F. Scott Fitzgerald wrote one draft of the script. Aldous Huxley wrote another draft later after they threw out Fitzgerald's version. And finally, neither of these writers got a film credit.
Who ended up with the credit? Do we know?
I don't know. Some script director who came in later on. Huxley, as a film writer for Hollywood, Huxley had some problems. He couldn't see, and he didn't like the movies in the first place. And so his big problem was that he couldn't visualize entries and exits from the stage. And of course, as you know, and anyone who knows theater and film knows that you have to do that. You have to put your characters on and off the stage. So he was a successful film writer. He earned a ton of money and sent it back home to the relatives of his wife so they could leave Europe. And it was very expensive to leave and difficult to leave Europe in that period. So later on, I could say in World War II, he became a mystic. He separated himself from the fancy upscale Hollywood community that I could play you another piece about, but we're out of time. He friends with Greta Garbo, Thomas Mann, Orson Welles. It was a very swank world up there in the Pacific Heights and Santa Monica, where all these great European intellectuals were living. It was really an amazing period. That's what drove me to write Huxley in Hollywood. I always wondered, how could a Huxley brainiac kind of guy like him, a man for whom the term highbrow was invented, how could he be out there slugging it out with all those Hollywood stars? And he did, and it worked for a while. But then nothing like being a pacifist during World War II. And finally, his film career ended, and he turned to writing essays. And I suppose had a column in Esquire. And perhaps it's tragic to note that very few people noticed his death because it was on November 22nd, 1963.
The same day of John F. Kennedy's killing, correct?
So it's a real pleasure finding people who are interested in Aldous Huxley. I've spent altogether too many years tracking him, producing a radio documentary, an oral history collection. If any of you ever get to the Huntington Library in San Marino outside Los Angeles, there's 100 of my interviews there, all transcribed and kind of fun to read if you like to get into this world. This is really the story of Mank. Huxley wrote his novel about William Randolph Hearst. If you've seen that film, he's a character in there, and sent up, made fun of William Randolph Hearst and managed to get away with it in a way that Herman Mankiewicz could not and Orson Welles could not. It's mysterious. But then he brought a sort of English highbrow juju to Hollywood, and that's, I think, how he managed to survive.
I have one last question because I've wondered about this. Later in his career, how did he view the popularity of Brave New World? Did he resent it? Was he grateful
for it? No, anyone that writes 60 books is just happy if they, you know, they're still in print. I only have 10, and I am constantly trying to figure out if this one is in print and that one is in print. And, you know, you live off your royalties. Huxley was a professional author. He turned out 2 and 3 books a year. Yeah, a little bit sobering for some of us.
That's incredibly prolific.
But Brave New World left a legacy for people in that I think it inspired many of us to distrust all-powerful world governments to hope that some of the things that we had to give up in order to be human, we could get back.
David, thank you so much.
My pleasure. And if I turn some people on to reading Huxley or Huxley in Hollywood, I'm to the good. I really appreciate that. And thank you for your attention all this time.
That's David Dunaway, along with Radio West executive producer Christy Miners. If you're interested in becoming a member of the Radio West Book Club, you can go to our website, radiowest.org, for more information. And we'd love to have you join us in March as we read They Called Us Enemy by George Takei. I'm Doug Fabrizio.